and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Look at that. It's Monday. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. How are you, lurking conservatives? Want to say thank you to the state of Vermont. Riley had a great time up there.
I heard.
You've only been up there once, I know.
Only been up there
a long time ago. There's some good people up there. Chris helped me out at the station over there. And then there was Anna and Kevin brought cookies to the show. Very nice people. Answered some questions for the folks in Vermont. Want to say hi to Kelly in Vermont because she said it would make her life. So I thought I would do that. Look at this. Kalo's back on the board. Haven't seen him
fresh
for a week.
From Seattle, Washington.
He's been to Seattle, where apparently, and I don't want to be kind of boys clubby, but I heard that what did you do up there exactly for a week? Just tell me what you did vaguely.
I had so much sex.
There you go. That's what Seattle's for, I guess.
Look, I had a lot.
That's good, man.
I mean, I've had relationships.
Yeah.
This was a lot.
Okay. All right. So you got in about 6 months worth in about a week?
Well, in the first 2 days.
Oh, boy. Now let's.
It was like 8.
All right.
I mean, that's just crazy. Like, I needed fluid.
I guess I just want to say welcome back. And
it's great to be back.
People are checking their dial. What happened? Why are they talking about this so early? This is the time you do it. This is the time, I think, you know, landing, you know, coming down from a Rachel show, we go right in. We want to make the switch into Boys Club very defined. Want to make sure it's very defined. So, like, how many times did you have sex total, Chris, do you think?
You know, honestly, we lost count. Like, it's just a blur of nakedness.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't have such stories, though I had a good time in Vermont. You know, but I'm married, and we had nice hotel time.
Oh, nice.
I'm being diplomatic here because I'll let you cover the filth
she
for this show.
Nipple ring.
Hey!
I'm just saying.
Well, you know, I had a conversation with young Jesse, who has decided to look at. Jesse works on the Rachel Maddow show, and we had a discussion about those kind of ornamentation, that kind of body. What would you call that?
Mutilation.
Well, no, I don't like that word. It's not mutilation. It's ornamentation. It's
accoutrement.
So, but I once had a problem with it because they're intimidating at first. You're like, how do you work them? You know, what am I supposed to do? What's my part in this?
It's true.
Yeah, it is, because you're not sure. Like, do they hook up to things? But I don't want to get too crass. But in reaching out to the women who have nipple rings and might want to talk about why they have them, I had a woman I went out with in college who I saw much years later, who had, since I knew her, gotten them. And I was like, what are those? Are those just for decoration? And she says, no, they were not sensitive before, but now that I have these, they are. So it's sort of like an extension of your nervous system. So maybe you shouldn't be so selfish, Jesse, and think that that nipple rings are all about you. They're like, hey, I don't like it. It's not my type of toy. Maybe it's not for you. Do you understand? Get on the mic, you little man. He's pushing a mic in your face. Do you understand? Maybe it's about them. Maybe they're reaching out and extending their pleasure.
Well, I think the question that I think needs to be asked is, what does it say about your personality if you're willing to go out and do things to your body that I think we can say were never intended by God or evolution?
Whoa.
The
God argument is, I don't even want to have. But it sounds to me that on an evolution level, it's completely appropriate to evolution. Someone's sitting there going, how could I make it more fun? I know, I can add this. That's called adaptation. So on an evolution level,
well,
I think,
but the other thing is that it does concern both parties. And if I am so repulsed that I cannot, you know, engage in the act of procreation because of what happens to be adorned on this woman.
Wait a minute, you can't do your woman?
Yeah, see, here
is
I was
trying to.
So here's what I was saying, Jesse, is that on evolution in terms of pleasure. But I see what you're saying. That then I guess you're out. I guess what that means is, like, if you can't take it, you can go ahead and find somebody else.
If you want to be responsible for the end of the human species, by all means, head down to St. Mark's Street and get yourself a tattoo.
St. Mark's, please. We're not talking about tattoos. We're talking specifically about, I think the conversation was about nipple rings. I have problems with tattoos myself. My brother has apparently a masterpiece of a tattoo on his back. I never knew what to tattoo on myself. The only thing I could think of is, like, if lost, please return to, you know, put my parents' name. or maybe my wife's name. But the nipple ring argument, I think, has to do with pleasure. It's not always about you and, you know, how you see the woman. Do you understand what I'm saying? I feel this conversation grinding down.
It's going over a little my head, the not about me thing. But.
Yeah, I know. I understand. It took a long time for me to learn that it wasn't all about me, and you will, too. It's not clear about this opening segment. But apparently, this opening segment is all about us and me. And I do want to say one thing. Thank you for pitching in, fellas. It's nice to have you back, Kalo. But Brendan apparently brought a brisket buffet in for breakfast. I've seen him three times. He's come into this room with three different sandwiches. What is? Was that one sandwich? How
many sandwiches? There was brisket. There was corned beef. Somebody had corned beef in there.
Oh, God, this is great. Well, here's what I'm going to confess to you a day early from the Liberal Confessional. I'll probably confess it again tomorrow. So I'm up in Vermont. I'm at Libby's Diner in Vermont. My wife and I are there. Now, you got to understand that given all the stress I've been going through, I've been compulsively eating, of course. So I'm at Libby's Diner, and it's one of those classic diners where, you know, they got the blueberry pancakes, they got eggs and bacon, and it's just like old school, great stuff. I get a biscuit with my breakfast, and the waitress says, "Do you want sausage gravy with that? I could give you a half order of biscuits and gravy." And I'm like, I have to immediately suck her into my world. I'm like, no, I'm not eating meat right now, you know, because I decided a few months ago that I'm not going to eat meat, and I feel better about not eating meat. And she's like, "Do you want the gravy?" And I'm like, "I don't know, let me think about it a few minutes and then get back to me. Can I tell you later?" She's like, we had that face. So I'm like, "I have work to do. I'm not here to babysit whatever little problems you have." So what happens? I go through about half the biscuit and I'm like, I'm looking at my wife and I'm like, "I'm going to do it. I'm going to have some sausage gravy." And I did it, man. I had a big old side of sausage gravy. I filled my stomach with pig, Riley. And let me tell you something, excellent. And it's just setting the stage, my friends.
Did you do this?
Well, yeah, I did it on Saturday, man. Saturday morning, sausage gravy.
Okay, and today's Monday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've still got a stampede of pigs just coursing through my bloodstream,
exactly,
my friend. And I enjoyed it.
Just about finishing wreaking havoc with your intestines.
No, well, I'm okay. But here's the big question is, do I continue this? Am I setting the stage to eat turkey on Thursday? Or should I just look at it as a vegetarian slip, although I eat fish?
No.
I should just get back into it full-heartedly?
If you like it.
Of course I like it.
That brisket smelled good
this morning.
The brisket smelled excellent. You can't just do it if you like it, if you're like me, because that just means that you'll end up... You know, if I did that, Riley, I would end up in a hotel room, 400 pounds. I'd end up like Elvis, dying on a toilet.
Well, I'm not saying like eat when you're not hungry or something.
Oh, boy, let's do some news. Let's do some news. Hey, folks, you better learn how to speak Chinese because it's coming. While we're out in the world, you know, pillaging other countries and depleting the government treasury of all its resources, China is out there reaching out to Africa, out there building dams in Brazil. Our little president goes to China and he's treated like a child. He's sitting there. First of all, he goes to China and he's basically like, "Hey, can you guys make the currency a little different so we can make the dollar a little worthwhile?" And the Chinese guy's like, "No, I don't think so."
Yeah, and then he was in front of a Christian Chinese choir, and he started talking to the...
Is there a recording of that?
Yeah, I don't know. But he started talking about the Chinese allowing more freedom of religion, and they got the same kind of answer, which was no answer at all.
Well, I just think that it's very interesting to me that Americans are going to have to sit with the fact that they are not... we're certainly barely the superpower now, but it looks like China, while we're busy just ruining the planet for selfish reasons, is going to take over the world, without a doubt, in my head. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. Here's a funny moment in China. Bush apparently was at a press conference and one of the reporters got him in a vulnerable moment and said, "Respectfully, sir, you know we're always respectful. In your statement this morning with President Hu, you seemed a little off your game. You seemed to hurry through your statement. There was a lack of enthusiasm. Was something bothering you?" And the president gets defensive. He's like, "You ever heard of jet lag? Well, good. That answers your question." And then he gives a very quick follow-up, and Bush cut him off and said, "You may not have a follow-up." And he stormed off, apparently, the podium and went to leave the room in a huff, and the doors were locked. How funny is that? This is the president going, "Let me out. Let me," and he's got to go back to the podium and say, "All right, so I guess that didn't work. I was trying to escape." And I love moments like that because this president certainly his father threw up in Japan. Wasn't that where he threw up? Was it Japan?
I think it was Japan.
Well, he goes to China and he's made a fool of himself in this way. And the thing I like about, if I like anything about this president is that, when he makes a fool out of himself, there's no coming back from it. You know,
because he's accomplished very little of what he went over there to do. Now, remember, he just came back from South America, spent like 24 hours in the States, and then headed off to Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Two trips, two different continents, virtually two different hemispheres.
Mm-hmm.
And what has he got to show for it?
Not much. It seems like he's just avoiding things here, Riley, because things are certainly hitting the fan on this side of the world.
Well, yeah, and he's got Hugo Chavez in Venezuela making him look like a complete idiot, and he's got the Chinese making him look like a complete idiot. He's got the South Koreans making him look like an idiot when the South Koreans announced while he was there that they're pulling their troops out of Iraq. Well, what else can you ask for?
Well, let's go into that Hugo Chavez thing just a little bit. This is very interesting that Hugo Chavez is going to be selling some discount heating oil here in the States. We'll get into that in just a second. This is a profound slap in the face from one of the great socialist leaders of this planet, the few that are left. 16 past, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
One past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
You.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We're going to get over the hump today, man. It's funny, on Mondays, all of us are, you know, we've all been on the regular weekend schedule, and then everyone's walking around looking all glazed-eyed, all punchy and tired. But no, we're not going to let it happen. We're going to fight the tired monster. I swear to God, sausage and biscuits and gravy, it's a gateway drug for me, man. I'm in trouble. This is a slippery slope, man. I'm only a few days away from bacon, from turkey, from heroin. Do you see how it works? Do you see how it works, Riley?
I see
how I'm going to end up at all-night biscuits and gravy.
Wait a minute. Wait. Hold up.
What?
Sausage is not the same as turkey. Let's be clear. All right? Turkey is a vaunted American tradition.
Like sausage isn't?
Sausage is pig intestines.
No, dude. Wait a minute. I'm only kidding. Made their own sound before they became what you're putting in your mouth. So when something goes like, you know... Or like, look. Either way, it was a beautiful part of God's life and world and whatever. And just,
that's right.
Come on. Now, you know,
but I love turkey.
I'm about to go into some sort of skid here. Let's do this. Venezuela will start selling discount heating oil to poor people in Boston and New York. That's Venezuela. You heard it right. Hugo Chavez has offered to help the poor of this country from the reserves of his state-run oil company. This is very noble, and it's got to bite Bush in the behind just a bit. I mean, what a sweet slap in the face to our aristocratic corporatocracy with fascist leanings. Citgo, which is a subsidiary of the Venezuelan oil company, has about 16,000 stations here in the States, and they will be offering cheaper heating oil perhaps next week. In Boston, up to about 1.2 million gallons of the fuel will be available and will be sold later here in New York in the Bronx. Chavez blames the plight of the poor on unbridled capitalism. I think it actually says that on our new $50 bills.
Actually, that would be pretty accurate.
Of course, unbridled capitalism.
You remember when I told you
that there was a reason
why I went to Citgo?
Yeah.
And I use Citgo gas exclusively? Because Hugo Chavez is cool.
And this all came about, I guess the idea was put into his head by Jesse Jackson at
a meeting.
He met
in August with Reverend Jackson. And, you know, I mean, look, Venezuela has had huge windfall profits from the oil industry. What Chavez has done, unlike most of the rest of these greedy bastards with the money, is to pour it into poor communities in and around Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, and really has tried to elevate the plight of the poor in his own country.
Right.
And now he's reaching out and trying to elevate the plight of the poor in this country. People are going to be hit with 75% increases in home heating oil in places like the Bronx, in places like Boston. So this is going to be a godsend to some people.
It's going to be a bad winter for some people. It's going to be really difficult. See, that's what happens when you get a country that actually builds a government that actually helps the people. God forbid in this country anyone actually talks about half-socializing anything just to help the people that have nothing.
Yeah, and remember that this is the same guy that Pat Robertson wanted to bump off not that long ago.
Well, you could see that that type of thinking would be there. When something like this happens, when a guy who has a country that works effectively in the sense that it can provide its people with some basic needs, you know, on behalf of the government, How could that not be threatening to someone like Pat Robertson or George Bush or the capitalists that run this place? I sound like a commie today, don't I? I sound like a big old commie. The main element that the Iraq War shares with the Vietnam War, outside of the fact that it is a unwinnable war militarily, that it is a guerrilla war, that we were lied into it, is that the public is now turning against the war. During the Vietnam War, that was a signal of the end in defeat. The Republicans Party is starting to, basically all the GOP guys, a lot of them, the senators, the congressmen, are starting to distance themselves from the president, while the president seems to be distancing himself from reality as he runs around Asia pretending like he matters in the world. The Senate passed an amendment demanding progress reports from Iraq last week, and then we had that whole situation in the House. I need you to explain this to me a little bit. So Democratic Representative John Murtha from Pennsylvania, a 37-year-old, a 37-year Marine vet, an ex-drill sergeant, puts out a proposal to the House that says, look, we got to get out in 6 months. There's a way to do this. Then he's hijacked. His proposal is hijacked by the Republicans, who draft a proposal of their own saying, we need to get out, like, tomorrow.
Yeah.
And then pushes all of the Democrats to basically vote for their proposal because it's too extreme, and they don't want to look like they were actually, what, against the war? I thought they were obviously on board with this.
Well, look, what it did, and this is the one positive benefit of, you know, the right wing in the House overreacting and overreaching. It, you know, then they start debating this particular measure. And at a point, a congresswoman named Jean Schmidt from Ohio, she's the one that beat Paul Hackett for that seat out in Ohio. You remember that a couple of years ago?
Yeah, she's a disrespectful loudmouth.
And what she did was say to send Congressman Murtha a message, cowards cut and run, Marines never do. And that all hell broke loose on the floor of the House of Representatives.
Right.
Democrats rightly jumped up and said, what are you, nuts? What, you people are pathetic. And then she had to pull back and retract that statement from the record, which is highly unusual.
Well, but what I want to know is, why the hell didn't these Democrats just say, all right, so the Republicans put a proposal that says, we want to end the world tomorrow. Why couldn't these Democrats just go, yes? Why couldn't they all get on board? I mean, there's enough public outcry that shows that they would be substantiated in their if they call them on this bluff. I mean, the hedging that the Democrats are doing is disturbing. I mean, what has to happen for them to get some sort of collective spine? I mean, do they not feel like they have the control of the issue? Is their confidence to sell it to constituents or possible voters diminished?
They're scared, except for three of them. And you know who they are? Jose Serrano from the Bronx, Cynthia McKinney from Georgia, and Robert Wexler from Florida.
We're going to talk to Howard Dean later in the show, and I'm going to ask him what we got to do to get these Democrats to act like they've got some, or to act like they at least have confidence. I mean, this doesn't make any sense to me. In a minute, we're going to talk about the leak investigation, because someone's singing, and it's, this is a different leak. Well, a lot of stuff. 27 past.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Right, 34 past the hour. It's Monday. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Thank you, Vermont. Had a lovely time up there. I would move up there in a second if I could figure out what I would do, like, day three or four. You know, the first 2 days
relax,
would be nice.
Bro.
I know. I'd relax. I'd sleep. I'd get into the groove. I'd find my coffee shop. I'd spend the day there. I'd start smoking again.
Look, I had a friend who moved from Connecticut to Vermont. He comes out of that state, it seems like, once every 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, they're their own world up there. I definitely felt that there was a certain amount of, like, yeah, a lot of things are going on down there in that other world. But up here, you know, we have their own thing. And, you know, I did what you do up there, Riley. I had some apple cider donuts.
Whoa.
I had some Vermont cheese. Look at me. Can you tell?
Vermont cheese is wonderful.
I haven't had the time to do my pre-seeing my mother fast, so she'll like me when I show up. I have not, I'm afraid that I'm going to be too chunky for my mom to like me.
You going to Florida for Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
You eating your mom's cooking?
I'm going tomorrow, buddy.
Uh-oh.
You're on your own Wednesday. And then you're out next week. Wow. We're heading into the holiday season, man.
Come on.
I'm waking up. I'm trying. Here we go. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. Wow, that was loud in my headphones. A lot of Brendan in my head. Here we go. From Reuters, Bush joins Chinese athletes for bike ride. Bush joins Chinese athletes for bike ride. Translation, Bush attempts to coast all the way to 2009. All right. From the New York Times, Rice says she wasn't Woodward's leak source. Rice says she wasn't Woodward's leak source. Translation, Condi denies helping Bush leak. Come on, it's all in there. There's a couple ways to look at that. She's holding the thing. All right, here we go. Wait, all right, here we go. From the Associated Press, report school crime cut in half over 10 years. School crime cut in half over 10 years. Translation, wedgies shoved in locker no longer classified as crimes. Yeah, all right. Ah, the good old days. Let's get into this. The plane leak is seriously back on the front burner here, Riley, thanks to Bob Woodward, one-time great journalist who fleshed out the Nixon administration and their cover-up and now is part of the neocon death cult cover-up. Who was his source that has thrown a wrench into the into Investigator Fitzgerald's timeline? We reported here last week it was National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. That has been corroborated.
That was according to Raw Story, yeah.
Raw Story now has been corroborated by the Times in London. Hadley has been cagey about it. The White House says it wasn't him. Some are saying it was former State of Secretary of State Richard Armitage, who was against the war in the first place. And if it was him, that would make a lot of things different, wouldn't it, Riley?
It would really kind of destroy the frame that's been built thus far.
Right.
Because Armitage, as you correctly point out, was one of those State Department people, along with Colin Powell, who didn't really want to get into the war in the first place.
Well, I'm going to go with Hadley, because I believe that's what's going on. I'm not going to let them start to reframe this thing. And I'm even starting to think that Woodward is doing this because his sugar daddies in the neocon death cult have called in a favor and sent him out to confuse things. That's what I think. And I'm going to tell you right now, I don't know if that's being conspiratorial or not, but it's not going to work because Mighty Patrick Fitzgerald has impaneled a new grand jury to get to the bottom of this. See, he never said that Libby was certainly the first one that leaked it to the press.
He used the word known.
The first known person. So now all this has done is instigated more of an investigation. But what are the chances that Woodward is just operating at the behest of the neocon death cult because he owes them, because they made his later career by giving him the access to them?
Well, what has happened in terms of this leak speculation is that it's centered on Armitage, because Armitage did not flat out deny that he was a leak. He would not comment. Hadley has flat out denied, but the London Times story says that he's a leaker despite his denial.
Yeah, well, they've certainly lied before. They're apparently not that afraid of, if he didn't lie under oath, it's not perjury, so we don't know what he's done under oath. I'm assuming that he has testified.
Yeah,
Hadley has.
You know, Condoleezza Rice looked about as convincing as this little board here, which she was up there. Well, it wasn't me.
I think what they're trying to do is diminish the importance of it, that the new frame has to do with, like, hey, it's no big deal, but I'm going to stick by this. I think that, you know, Libby is obviously guilty. I think that Cheney is guilty. There's no reason not to believe that all the information was manipulated out of the vice president's office. I believe it was Hadley. I think that Woodward is being put forth as a means to confuse things, and I think he's operating on behest of the neocon death cult. I don't think this just happened at nowhere.
Well, it may not have. And the thing people really need to focus on here, because people are starting to say, as you point out, Woodward is framing this as being not that big a deal. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, it was just gossip. It was just that. It was gossip that could have cost people their lives.
Right.
You're talking about covert CIA operatives. And these folks now will say, well, we had no idea that she was covert. We had no idea she was actually involved in an operation. Well, before you dropped her name, you should have checked.
Well, he's going to be on, Bob Woodward's going to be on Larry King tonight, so I'm going to be curious to sort of watch him talk and see where he's at. He's a very cagey guy in some respects. He was able to keep a secret for some 30 years, so it's not like he's not a pro. But let's get out of the plane case for a minute and get into what is going to be the biggest case to ever hit congressional scandals, I believe. And we've been sort of following this here, and it's fairly convoluted in some respects, but in some respects not. On Friday, an amazing gift was given to the country. Tom DeLay's former spokesperson and Jack Abramoff, the incredibly sleazy power lobbyist who is under investigation and has been charged with some criminal charges recently. His business partner, Michael Scanlon, was charged with conspiracy to defraud Indian tribes of millions of dollars and has started to sing to save his own behind. Mr. Scanlon and Mr. Abramoff collected about $82 million in fees from Indian tribes over 4 years. $82 million. That is lobbying like has never been seen before. Now, Scanlon has he's been charged with conspiracy, so now he's going to, help out.
Sing. Like Pavarotti.
He is going to help them. I'm going stupid here. So, as I mentioned Friday, the federal prosecutors who are investigating Jack Abramoff are starting to see he is the center of emanating concentric circles of greed and corruption. It's just like ripples on a dirty pond, Riley, that touch at least 36 members of Congress and the Senate, perhaps. Already, you've got Representative Nye from Ohio.
Yeah.
He's up to his neck in this. He's been subpoenaed in the investigation. He's the chairman of the House Administration Committee. He helped Abramoff get his agenda on the congressional record, and he facilitated meetings for favors and money. This is all about bribing and owning public officials. John T. Doolittle, a Republican of California, has admitted that his wife, who helped Abramoff organize fundraisers, has been subpoenaed. The investigation has already caused a White House official to resign before he was arrested. That
Safavian.
Was David H. Safavian. A budget official. DeLay is suspected of involvement. Perhaps officials from the Department of Interior might go down with this. I mean, at least 33 lawmakers received a total of $850,000 from Casino Jack and the Indians between 2001 and 2004. Trent Lott, Tom DeLay, David Vitter of Louisiana, Tad Cochran of Mississippi, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. I mean, what the implications that this has, if it really turns out to be the scandal that it's possibly becoming, could completely turn around the House of Representatives.
Well, it could cause several members of the House to either lose their jobs and or go to jail, because some of these things seem to be not just blatant violations of House ethics rules, but violations of law. And that's the important thing. And of course, when it comes to Scanlon and Abramoff, these guys are business partners. They've managed to get $82 million out of these Indian tribes. Now, assuming that Abramoff was totally blameless here, does that mean that Scanlon took all the money? Scanlon engaged in this conspiracy all by himself? That will not hold water. They were business partners, and you got to figure one knew what the other one was doing, and the other one is probably just as dirty as the first one.
Well, it's just amazing how they were to work this to their advantage. I mean, that's what really went on. They were able to get congressmen and senators to write letters to the Department of the Interior.
Gail Norton.
In Gail Norton's office to try and forbid Indian tribes of getting gambling or casino licenses in certain states. But they were playing two tribes against each other to make money for themselves. And now it's starting to turn out because of that, because they've built these tribes out of millions and millions of dollars, that it's just coming around to really bite them in the butt. And that's and how many of these congressmen are going to go down with this? Most of them are Republicans. There's a couple of Democrats. As I said last week, you know, Harry Reid had written a letter on behalf of Abramoff and Scanlon to the Department of the Interior, but so did the Republican senator from Nevada. And if there's anyone who is actually representing people who have gaming interests, it would be him. So I'm going to let him off the hook. I don't think he's dirty.
Well, let me tell you something. It seems to me that the Department of Interior has got an awful lot to answer for. Gail Norton seems to be running that department like Ed Norton would have run it. It doesn't make sense logically that the woman who is in charge of this department is allowing people to influence peddle, and you can spell that P-I-M-P, the interests of that Interior Department that easily. It's ridiculous.
And this guy was subcontracting as well to other countries. Didn't you tell me the story about someone paid $900 to President of Gambone? Was it
$9
million?
Abramoff asked for $9 million to arrange a meeting between Bush and the President of Gabon. It didn't happen. The meeting happened, but there's no record that he was actually paid anything for it. But that's how brazen this man was in terms of playing both ends against the middle, and influence peddling. There are problems ethically with the notion of you pimping your access to a government official for money that you put in your own pocket.
Well, maybe this, hopefully he'll go down and bring a bunch of these dirty Republicans down with him, and then they can change the face of lobbying and put it back to what it was meant to represent, as opposed to just corporate interests or personal interests or political interests. I mean, I have to assume that lobbying was originally not intended to be used how some of these guys use it.
The Democrats need to be out front on this, even though there are going to be some Democrats whose ox will be gored by this expanding scandal. The Democrats need to get out in front of it by coming up with a specific program to address these kinds of abuses.
Dude, they've got to come up with a specific program to address everything. I mean, it seems
like...
We
can talk to Howard Dean about it.
Well, I know. We're going to have Howard Dean here in the last hour. We can ask him some questions because something needs to happen. I mean, it is so ripe right now. There's such a window of opportunity to begin to build a platform that can effectively, you know, block the Republicans from having any success in future elections at all if they were clever enough and they were all on the same page. And we'll definitely talk to Howard Dean in a couple hours about the possibilities of that happening. I guess we can talk a little bit more about Abramoff in a second. I also want to get into, are you living in one of the most dangerous cities in the country? You'll find out in a second. It's 46 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Dar Williams. After a long night of electric guitar solos, pyrotechnics, trashed hotel rooms, and bad eating, I listen to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Hope you're having a decent Monday morning. We're all trying to pull it together and wake up here. I'm not sure what's happening. Sometimes on Mondays, everybody's just in this... You know what happens? It's getting towards the holidays. We got Thanksgiving coming up. Part of your brain just detaches. But I'll tell you, heading into these holidays, we've got a lot to be grateful for in terms of the tide changing in this country, in terms of attitudes changing in this country towards the war, towards the president. There's some great indications that legal action is being taken successfully against the corruption within the administration, within the House and the Senate. I mean, these are all very exciting things. They'll even be more exciting when the Democrats have a cohesive platform that we could find some faith in, or even a third party candidate shows up and some sort of miraculous amount of charisma and inspiration leads the country out of this mire, at least ideologically. Hopefully that will happen. I don't know. We got an interesting email here, Riley. Mark and Mark, yes, we agree. Mirtha believes that war is spinning out of control and we should get out, but that is not his greatest fear. Mirtha realizes that the commander in chief is cracking up and out of touch with reality. Should we have another national crisis, our country will be in an extremely vulnerable position. Consider Hurricane Katrina's aftermath. We are currently rudderless and vulnerable. That's from Craig in Seattle. I'll tell you, when I was reading the New York Times on Sunday, I got a very similar feeling. You know, when I was reading about the war, the costs of the war, where the war is really at, the stubbornness of this administration not to make decisions to start to pull out of this situation, the amount of money it's costing, then I saw that how China was reaching out throughout the world. Then I read another article on how the aftermath in New Orleans is so devastating. I watched on 60 Minutes. It looks like a war zone there. That city is done for. I mean, the possibilities of New Orleans rebuilding itself in anything that looks like the same way it was is almost non-existent. And there are speculators. These are professors who are speculating that the amount of erosion that happened in New Orleans because of the levee break has like speed hot rotted it into being in 80 years that the whole place could be underwater. But what I'm getting at is that the one thing I did feel was a type of fear that I had not experienced, was that we are really vulnerable. The country is really vulnerable. And what this president has done with his legislation, with his actions, and with his administration has really compromised the security integrity of this country. And I felt it profoundly just by the selection of stories I read on Sunday.
Well, see, what you're beginning to see, Mark, is, I think, a different view of the way the world sees America, and the way the world sees America and America's leader in this. And, you know, a lot of people across the world really never thought that the United States would elect this guy to a second term. There were a lot of folks that just said, thought to themselves, oh, gee, there's no way in the world that could happen given what he had done in the first term. Now that he's been elected to a second term, people, not just both inside the United States and outside the United States, traditional allies are starting to peel away from this guy. Whether it's Rick Santorum in Pennsylvania not even attending Bush's Veterans Day speech in his home state, or whether it's the South Koreans announcing as Bush was setting foot in their country that they're pulling their troops out of Iraq. It's the same impulse in two very different places in the world. And that's what you're beginning to see. You're beginning to see people say, look, let this man stand alone because we have no clue what it is he's doing.
I'm embarrassed. You know, I'm embarrassed. Here, like Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said on Sunday, in terms of China's army, that one of the concerns she has is that they have a 2.5 million member army and there's a question of intent. That's a little scary for her to say that there's a question of intent. And as you said, in South Korea, the day he was there, they're pulling out a third of their 3,200 troops in Iraq. Scott McClellan said John Murtha, former Marine colonel who served in Vietnam, the representative from Pennsylvania, who wanted to put in some a proposal to bring the troops out in 6 months, said, this is Scott McClellan, quote, the policy positions of Michael Moore and the extreme liberal wing of the Democratic Party, unquote, are what Murtha is representing. For that slime, for that weasel, Scott McClellan, that powerless, you know, ambiguous, you know, spineless person to take that kind of shot, it's just, it's disconcerting. It's getting to the point where my anger is sort of devolving into a type of fear of, when is this going to stop? When are we going to get our country back? When are we going to, you know, not be afraid that we're leaving? I'm just completely frightened that the entire infrastructure of the country is crumbling, and that all we have to really rely on is the spirit of the American people to rise up.
Well, you know, it's interesting that a couple days after McClellan made that statement linking John Murtha to Michael Moore, how he did that, I'll never know, Bush actually had to come back and sort of back up a little bit off the administration's dogging of John Murtha, because there was such a backlash against the administration. This is no Michael Moore. This is no flaming.
No. This is real. You know, it's partisan anger that is justified. It is justified on behalf of the Democrats to be angry at the behavior of the Republicans in the House, and certainly the behavior of Gene Schmidt, who, you know, is
reprehensible.
It's reprehensible. And who the hell is she? Yeah, who the hell is she? All right. It's 56 past. I wanted to read a few of these. These are the safest and most dangerous cities in the United States. And if you live in any, give us a call and give us a report at 866-303-2270. We've got number 10, Birmingham, Alabama. Number 9, these are the bad ones, Gary, Indiana. Number 8, New Orleans. Number 7, Atlanta. Number 6, Baltimore. Number 5, Richmond, Virginia, one of the most dangerous. Did not know that. 4, Flint, Michigan. 3, St. Louis. 2, Detroit. Obviously, what's sad about this list is these are some of the more poor country, cities in this country, and obviously are being cut loose in a certain respect. Certain cities get out of control, and obviously the danger rate becomes sort of relative to how much poverty is in that city. I'll give you the number 1 in just a second. If you live in any of those, 866-303-2270. If you want to talk to Mark and I about what your city looks like, give us a call. Give us a call about anything. We're a little punchy, and we wouldn't mind talking to you, seeing where your head's at. 57 past, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's 6 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Kalo is back on the board from the Seattle vacation. Say something, you dummy. I said your name. You're going to stand there and let it dangle? What the hell is that?
What's up, sweetie?
All right, that's all. That's all I needed. Is that so hard? Riley's here. We're all here. I was in Vermont. I'd like to thank the people up there at the station up there, WVAA. Thank you so much for the hospitality, for putting me up at the Sheraton, for having a little meet and greet. It was a pretty interesting meet and greet that they had after the show on Friday there, Riley. One guy, Dan, came by. It's me and Dan, and we're hanging out, having a few scones, waiting for some other people to show, and then a couple other guys showed up, and I basically just rambled on and got bitter, but it was very nice to see the support. Everyone that came out to the shows were Air America Radio listeners. I want to thank Anna and Kevin for the spelt cookies that they homemade for Mishna and I. And I want to say hi to Kelly in Vermont. I want to thank also Libby's Diner for providing me a relapse into the world of meat, Jim Earl. I've relapsed into the world of meat, Jim Earl, and the wings, waiting to come out and do God knows what at this point. I'm telling you, people, even the guy who gave me the ride this morning, who never listens to our station, was like, what the hell was going on in there on Friday? What's up with that, with the squirrel? And everyone's very excited to watch you deteriorate mentally, because you get good comedy out of that, and it's worth the price. Isn't it, Jim? Yeah, we'll talk to Jim in a minute. He's just in the booth nodding at me. So let's get into some stories. We got some calls. Let me maybe give you the number one most dangerous. All right, let me give the whole list. Number 10, these are the most dangerous cities in this country, is Birmingham. I did that twice. Birmingham, Alabama. Number 9, Gary, Indiana. Number 8, New Orleans. Number 7, Atlanta. Number 6, Baltimore. Number 5, Richmond, Virginia. Number 4, Flint, Michigan. Number 3, St. Louis. Number 2, Detroit. Number 1, the most dangerous city in this country is Camden, New Jersey, Riley.
Camden, New Jersey.
How far is that from where you live?
A pretty good distance. Camden's right across the bridge from Philly.
Oh, that's right.
It's right across the bridge from Philly.
I've never really been to Camden.
It's still New Jersey.
It's still New Jersey.
Yeah, it's still New Jersey.
And it's like, apparently, I think it's one of those ones you go through on the train, because I remember looking through that. You go through Trenton, I know, on the train. Do you go through Camden on the train from New York?
You don't go through Camden.
I've never been to Camden, New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey. I have not been there. But I have been to most of these other cities, and some of them, it's weird because I wouldn't have known. Like Richmond, Virginia, I went to, and I would not have known that about Richmond. Baltimore, I've only been through once, and I've heard this about it.
I spent some time in Baltimore.
And apparently we've got a conflicting, apparently there's a city on that isn't on the list. It should be. Well, first let me talk to Brian here in Baltimore. Brian, how are you? Good morning. Now, I've never really spent much time in Baltimore. How long have you lived there, Brian?
Actually, I'm a lifelong resident. I'm 38. I've moved away 3 times, and something always brings me back.
Yeah, was it once a great city, Brian?
Yes, it was. One of the things that I wanted to bring up was, you know, Baltimore, Camden being number one, and Richmond. All three of them have one thing in common that I'm always complaining about with Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, there's been investments in revitalization of certain parts of the city, very distinct parts, waterfront, Camden, you had the aquarium, and I forgot the name of their, E-Center. E-Center.
Yeah, sure.
Baltimore, of course, got the Inner Harbor, which is a great project. It's done a lot for the city, but you drive 5 minutes out of any of those areas in any of these cities, and all you see are vacant houses. I mean, acres, blocks and blocks of vacant houses. One of the rough estimates at Baltimore is something like 25,000 vacant houses.
Well, this is one of those situations where, you know, this I think was the idea of urban renewal, where you take some sort of area that has been become economically depressed or unfeasible, you rebuild it, you make it a theme park, and certainly people, when they visit the city, will come in there and go to all the little shops and stores or the aquarium or go see the minor league team, but it does not help the infrastructure of the city, nor does it help the residents who lived in those areas before. If that money was more creatively spent, perhaps they could create a way of life for those communities to survive.
Right. Now, there's a glimmer of hope with Baltimore, and that is that it's sucking some of the economic vitality of D.C. I work in D.C., and you're starting to see some areas that you wouldn't normally expect where they're building new condos and apartments. But the same thing is happening. The residents that live there now certainly cannot afford to move back.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you mentioned D.C., Because D.C. used to be on the list. All the time, D.C. used to be on the list. Not on the list this time. You know another city that's not on the list this time? Newark, New Jersey. Newark, New Jersey routinely be in the top 10. No longer is. Now, one of the things that happened here in New York, when you talk about abandoned housing, you go back 15 years in New York, two-thirds of the abandoned housing in New York was owned by the city of New York. As they began to sell that off, those neighborhoods began to change to the point that now some of that same abandoned housing is getting sold for six figures.
And we had a project like that when I was in grade school. I think it was back in the 70s where they actually sold vacant houses for a dollar.
Yeah.
And the deal was that you had to make it habitable within a certain period of time. And same thing happened.
Yeah.
It changed neighborhoods. And, you know, in Baltimore, some of the great old neighborhoods are keep struggling to make comebacks, but they face one thing. A lot of the property is owned by wretched slumlords, which I won't get into right now. But, you know, Baltimore has a great neighborhood called Mount Vernon. I don't know if you had a chance to visit it. Beautiful, historical, great architecture. But I've lived in some of the apartments there, and I can just tell you, it's awful the way they expect people to live.
Hey, Brian, now, you know, this list is really about the most dangerous cities, and I guess we can make a direct connection between...
Well, I guess my connection is, though, with this kind of poverty and these kind of living conditions comes a sense of desperation.
Right.
And, I mean, I was once walking up a major thoroughfare in Baltimore and saw, it was 2 days before Thanksgiving, and saw people laying on the ground and some guy standing above them, and I thought they were laughing. But he was holding them up at gunpoint.
Oh, my God. So do you feel personally threatened? I mean, when you are in driving around Baltimore, do you...
I hate to admit it, but yes, sometimes I do. More walking. I mean, you know, I'll get out of my... Even sometimes sitting at traffic lights on my way home because I'm... You know, unfortunately, my other half wanted to move away, so we moved away. And I we'll go in the city, and we were at a traffic light once and heard gunshots in an alley.
Yeah.
Something I would have never saw growing up.
Yeah.
And I mean, I grew up right in the heart of the city, and it's you know, I see why it's there, though.
Yeah.
I see why we're on that list. It seems like every day we just had 8 people die in house fires this weekend, and it seems like every time we turn around, there's another murder or something.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Brian. Thanks for painting the picture for us. Well, you see what happens is that you got New Orleans on this list, and you have something like Katrina happen in a state that, in a city that was, you know, obviously poor, obviously dangerous, and then you get a lot of people, certainly right-wing thinkers, that are like, well, this is the best thing that ever happened.
Well, yeah, and
that's their solution.
One of the things that's confounding about this list is that, for example, Atlanta. Atlanta's not a poor city.
Right.
You talk to most people, Atlanta's booming. It's a, you know, it's a great town to live in, yet there is still this violence. Richmond, Virginia, not a broke city. Yet there's still all this violence going.
Well, look, it seems that Brian in Everett has something he needs to add. Should we do it now? Brian, there's a city on the list that you think is not on the list, it should be on the list?
Everett is the most dangerous. I'll tell you what.
Everett, Washington?
Everett, Washington, Brian.
It is the, it is run by a methocracy.
A methocracy?
Down the road is the first Stepford Church of Damage, and you walk around and you'll meet some real strong, tough guys who will stare you down, and they got a rifle in their house, and they got a woman that takes her used feminine products and buries them in a mason jar in the backyard, you know, and that kind of stuff. You can't walk around this town just like you're just walking around. I mean, yeah, safe, sure, it's safe if you're one of the mainstream of the dangerous people, it's all safe, sure.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear more stories about Everett?
Well,
I'll have to send you something about Everett.
Well,
you know, it really is the faith-based initiative to get you hooked on meth.
That gets you hooked on meth? Faith-based initiative?
It's a meth-based initiative. It really is.
Meth-based initiative.
It really is. It's really bad. And I just stay home. I don't leave the house.
Okay,
know?
Brian.
You want to know anything else?
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm really flying on the caffeine this morning, if that's okay with you.
That's okay with me, man. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye. Wow. What was that, burying something in the backyard in a mason jar?
I don't know. Look, we got the morning remembrance coming up. We're going to talk a little bit about New Orleans because we have been talking about at least dangerous cities. Man, I saw that thing on 60 Minutes last night. Did you see that, Riley?
No, I didn't see it.
Oh, my God. You know what? I've also got the list of the safest cities. Man, my brain is... kidding. But look, the New Orleans thing on 60 Minutes was devastating.
Well, this piece about New Orleans that it really hasn't come back at all yet.
We should talk about it. Not only that, it might not come back. And after this, I'll read the safest cities in the country. So stay with us. It's 16 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You know, whoever with his phone system can themselves in the mouth and eat their own waste. You know, that's what I say. So leave me alone. I'm trying to get a good take and replay it back on my touchtone pad. So can I play and get a good recording so I can hear how it sounds? I got an inconsistent mental disposition.
Next message.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Twenty-one past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We're talking about the most dangerous cities in the United States. We're also going to be talking about New Orleans, which was on that list. I wonder if these numbers came out before the flooding or after. It seems that now, given that there are so few people there, that it would have changed. But the safest cities, and I'll count them down from the bottom, 10, Cary, North Carolina, 9, Lake Forest, California, 8, Round Rock, Texas, 7, Thousand Oaks, California, 6, Troy, Michigan, 5, Brick Township, New Jersey, 4, Mission Viejo, California, 3, Amherst, New York, 2, Clarkstown, New York, and the number one safest city in the United States, Newton, Massachusetts. I was just there last week, Newton, Massachusetts.
Newton, Mass.
My buddy Louie comes from there. Now, I've not been to a lot of these. Where's Clarkstown, New York?
Rockland County. It's not far from here.
It's not.
No.
So these are just little towns? They're not really cities? Are they little cloistered kind of gated towns?
No, I mean, these are supposed to be 75,000 people and up. So Clarkstown must have at least a population of 75,000. Amherst, New York, which is way upstate, up near Buffalo, must also have 75,000.
Brick Township, New Jersey.
Brick Township, New Jersey. That's down in the south central part of the state.
Okay.
Yeah.
So these are the places you should move if you can tolerate that kind of lifestyle.
I don't know about moving there just because they got a low crime rate. First of all, the crime rate changes in cities and towns from year to year.
I keep getting in my head that these are the wealthier or poorer parts, but I'm obviously connecting poverty and crime, which is not necessarily the wrong connection to make, but these are the least dangerous. So, but Newton, Mass, a very wealthy suburb of Boston. But in thinking about these, where's the danger going to come from? If you don't have at least, like, I look at the dangerous cities, and all these have big walking areas. These are congested. Suggested sort of cities that have a real vibrant social life in terms of out on the street. Newton, Massachusetts, not much going on there. Newton Center, on any given day.
If you look at these top 10 safest cities, one thing jumps out.
What?
There is not a single one of them with a population of a half million or more.
Exactly, which means that there's probably no public transportation. There's probably no vibrant life in terms of being outdoors and driving around your cars and doing things. That's the amazing thing. When you go to, like, Burlington, Vermont, you realize, like, you go to the town, you hang out, you go to the coffee shop, you go to the restaurant, you go into the store. They have a little shopping area there, but that's it. That's what you're going to be doing. If you're going to live up there, you've got to sort of accept that this is your pattern. Now, granted, no matter where you live, your life sort of breaks into patterns. You go to that one place, you get that one thing, you do that thing a couple days a week. But it's nice to know when you live in a city that may be the pattern you're in. But if you want to break that pattern, there's thousands of other options.
Yeah, you would think. Now, for example, Mission Viejo, about 100,000 people live there.
Yeah.
So it's not a small town, but it is not a gigantic, bustling metropolis. Certainly not like an Atlanta or a Baltimore or places like that. That's for sure.
Well, hey, there's somebody. Let's take a couple of phone calls. Tony in New York, what's on your mind there, buddy?
What's up? How you doing?
Okay, right. How you doing?
Good. One place that I wanted to point out that has never made the news and any kind of headlines is Dallas, Texas. It's always ranked right up there at the top of the high crime list, and I never hear it published in any newspaper or anything like that.
Well, it didn't make the top 10
this
year.
Mm-hmm. No, sir. Birmingham, Alabama, Gary, Indiana, New Orleans, Atlanta, Baltimore, Richmond, VA, Flint, Michigan, St. Louis, Detroit, and Camden, New Jersey. No Dallas.
Well, they're going to have to try harder next year.
Yeah.
Well, they're revitalizing the downtown, but they say crime is low in the downtown, but they say crime is high, like in every other part of Dallas, like East Dallas and
sure, that's
the Highlands area.
We had a call from a Baltimore that said roughly the same thing in terms of that type of urban renewal. Thanks a lot for your call, Tony. Robin in New Jersey, what do you got, Robin? How
hey,
are you?
Hey, Robin.
Hi. As far as Brick Township,
yeah,
it's all old people.
It's all old people?
It's like Leisure Village. And I mean, there's millions of them.
That's so cool.
Brick Township
is... safe. I mean, they didn't say about auto accidents. They said that's fine.
You know who has a pretty big summer house in Brick Township, New Jersey? The mayor of Newark, New Jersey, Sharp James.
It's the it is the number five safest city in the country. Thanks for your
and
call.
Check on the age.
What's that?
Check on the age per capita in Brick.
Okay.
So no one's getting out much, you're saying?
Well, they're getting out, but they're not robbing.
They're not moving too fast.
Yeah.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks a lot for your call. Let's talk about New Orleans for a minute, because I'll tell you, I watched that 60 Minutes last night. It was very disturbing to me that not only is nothing, it's all very bad. It looks like a war zone there. You get this feeling that from news reports that some things are starting to perk up, that that some, like the French Quarter, is back in business, but that wasn't affected by the flood. So you have these areas that were not affected by the floods that are starting to function. But overall, in the city, it's not starting to function. I mean, only an estimated 60,000 people are spending a night in New Orleans these days, opposed to 500,000 before Katrina.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is not. And most of these residents, the guy who was the house inspector that was on 60 Minutes last night, said that a lot of these people are not expected to come back. They're not coming back. There's nothing to come back to. A lot of them didn't have insurance. The houses are gone. They're going to take bulldozers to neighborhoods, Riley.
Well, we said this at the time Hurricane Katrina hit. When you move that number of people, 250,000 people, out of a city, it is likely that many of them will decide not to return because they were living in troubled circumstances before they left. What's really troubling about this whole New Orleans thing is that they're still finding bodies. 13 weeks after Katrina hit, they are still finding bodies. The death toll now is at 1,053. And this is, unfortunately, part of what happens in America when they turn off the cameras and when they turn off the lights and the TV crews leave and people are left to have to live in this kind of abject both poverty and despair.
It was just gray, man. It looked like a bomb had gone off. And the reason they're still finding bodies, people are just now going back to their homes to see if there's anything salvageable. And the city is broke and getting worse. It's horrendous. 27 past. When we come back, Bob Baer and Morning Remembrance. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Is that our theme song for this show now? Is that what's going on? Don't Fear the Reaper? Is that what we're... All right, I get it. Were you smart enough to make that connection yourself, Caleb? Is that what...
Shut up.
Oh, what's that? What?
This is the first time that's happened.
Oh, it hasn't? Really?
I gotta tell you, I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
What?
What are you talking about? Jokes.
I'm sorry, buddy. I have not watched that show since 1983, maybe. I've not watched SNL in a long time. You know what I did do is I was in Vermont. My wife and I went to see North Country or whatever it is.
I saw that with my mom.
Horrendous. What a tedious, hackneyed piece of crap that was. And then I'm in the hotel room with my wife, and she's like, let's watch Wedding Crashers. And I'm like, no. She's like, come on, it'll be funny. That's horrendous. What is good about that movie?
Wedding Crashers?
Yeah, what is it? I did not get one deep laugh out of the entire thing. The premise was stupid. They weren't funny. What was good about that movie? Explain it to me.
That they were funny. And
but when were they funny? When?
When Vince Vaughn was like, hey, at least you don't have to deal with Sybil over there.
Line? So that okay, so that justifies the $8 for you? That's hilarious. See, you're
there are others. I'm sorry, I don't have a list.
You're the reason why we're losing. Do you understand? You're the reason why we're losing the war to keep integrity in at least pop culture on some level. To have good, those aren't comedy.
Can't blame him for that.
Well, he paid for the ticket.
I know, but we lost that war before 1980s.
But it's like there was a time where even crappy comedies at least were founded in something that was truly funny. The entire premise was stupid, and it wasn't slapstick enough to justify a faulty premise. It was just bad, Chris, and I blame you. Yeah. And my wife is just like you. She's an apologist for crap, and I won't. I'm not going to have it. I'm not going to have it.
That crap made
it
like $150 million.
Does that make it okay?
That made like $220
million. Did it really?
That was a huge hit.
But what does that make it okay?
No, it makes you cry.
Yeah. I can't. You know, it's weird. If I. Oh, yeah. Mort Mortensen just held up a piece of paper that said, so did Hitler. Hitler made $200 million. Let's get him going before he starts crying before this bit starts. Unfortunately, it is that time of week again when we here at Morning Sedition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Oh. Wow. Wow, that's a big Monday sigh.
Yeah.
You all right?
Yeah, all right. You know, the cat took a crap on the floor.
Oh, again?
Mm-hmm.
It really screwed up the cat, huh?
Well, a lot of sorrow. A lot of sorrow. A lot of cat sorrow.
Yeah. Who died?
Well, first person here is the Reverend Adrian P. Rogers.
Uh-huh.
Mark.
Yeah.
Reverend Adrian P. Rogers, a three-time president of the ultra-conservative Southern Baptist Convention that helped usher in a resurgence of fundamentalist Christians in politics, died Tuesday when his heart gave out while snorting eight balls and performing oral sex on 12 men at the same time.
Really?
Okay, wow. Keep in mind some of this information may be faulty. I don't have a fact checker, really. Associates say Rogers was a riveting preacher who helped revive the fundamentalist Christian message that everything in the Bible should be taken literally, except for all that embarrassingly stupid parts which God meant for the Mormons and Scientologists.
You want to...
A tissue?
Yeah, here.
Thanks.
Here. Wow.
Yeah. Thanks.
Must be allergies or something.
Yeah. Really rough tissue. In 1987, he founded the Love Worth Finding Ministry, which today broadcasts TV and radio programs to millions of people worldwide, eagerly awaiting God's message that they're all crap. Rogers was so popular at his Memphis church that members would sometimes gather at the airport to greet his returning flights and then shrink in fear at the incredible metal bird that was never mentioned in the Bible. Reverend Rogers is survived by 16 million Southern Baptists who still think Earth is 200 years old.
They do. Oh, boy.
They're good people.
Yeah, I guess.
We have a lot of Southern Baptist listeners.
Oh, sure. Mm. Yeah.
Ralph Edwards. Ralph Edwards, TV pioneer.
Yeah.
Ralph Edwards, the host and creator of Truth or Consequences and This Is Your Life, two of the most popular shows in television history, has just created another hit. This Is My Death. Oh. I thank Doug Krieger for that joke.
What did he have to do with it?
He emailed it to me.
He did?
That's right. During the 1950s, Edwards' shows were so popular that a town in New Mexico renamed itself Truth or Consequences.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the truth was that it was too close to a nuclear testing range, and the consequences were cancer.
Oh.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah. It's ironic.
I don't know what that means. Every installment of This Is Your Life started the same way. Edwards would surprise a hapless celebrity with the phrase, "This is your life," whereupon the celebrity would finally get the message that his career was over. remaining active throughout his 92 years, Edwards also created such well-known shows as The People's Court, Name That Tomb, The People's Consequences, Name That Court, The People's Tune, and Truth Court Consequences Tune People's Name Thus. Edwards requested that his remains be surprised by a guy with a camera and a microphone, and then wheeled into a room full of annoying relatives.
What do you want to do, blow your nose again or something?
Yeah, thanks.
Wow. Are you Osei Can You See? Did you just do Osei Can You See when blowing your nose?
Yeah.
Wow, that's patriotic.
I can sing the alphabet in burps.
Oh, I don't think we have time for that today.
This has been this week's Mort and Remembrance, Mark.
Yeah.
Until next week, this is Mort, Mort's Insane. I'm Wayne Gilman.
What?
Who's chopping onions?
Now, that show, Truth Court Consequences Tune People's Name, though?
Yes.
What network's that on?
It's on the WB.
Oh, Jim, you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah.
That was a great piece. I enjoy that piece a lot. I enjoy all the pieces you do. So do people across the country. I was talking to people in Vermont. They love the Jim Merle. They love the Kent Jones. They appreciate all the stuff. They even like Kalo when
he
talks.
This is a great ensemble cast we have here every day.
Yeah, it is. Let's not drive this into the ground here.
No, I just wanted to say, you don't want to mention Goliath?
Why? Oh, yeah, sure. Dave's great. The little Goliath is here. You know, he had a big weekend. What'd you do this weekend? Get on the mic there, Dave.
Oh,
come on, let's waste some airtime.
I worked for promotions here at Air America, and I went to the Gay Expo.
Oh, yeah?
And was at a booth there.
Yeah, how was that?
You were swamped, weren't you?
It was interesting.
Did you get any offers?
Yeah. I got like three, actually.
Really? What were they?
You have big hands. What else is big?
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Some guy just said that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And another guy said, "You're very pretty."
No.
"Are you gay?"
Yeah, really?
And I said no. And then, he apologized, so. Yeah.
And the other one.
And Fairwood said, "Got any pot?"
And the other one you can't talk about because.
The other one's just not as memorable, I guess. So.
But you didn't feel compelled.
And that guy, Greg Giraldo, was there, and Tom, the comedy writer. They were there going around to booths.
Tom Johnson, Pendejo, now works for Greg Giraldo. Yeah. They were out doing a segment for Greg's show?
Yeah.
Man, pretty soon I'll be back in the world of television, I hope. Hey, I'm kidding. It's all good. Thanks for sharing, but you didn't find any of the offers compelling enough for you to challenge your sexual identity.
No, definitely not.
Because how old are you?
23.
So you're almost out of the tunnel. You've got a couple more years to do that.
And you still have a girlfriend?
I don't currently have a girlfriend.
Oh.
But, you know.
Yeah, all right.
Well, with big hands like that, I'm sure that won't
happen. 44 past the hour. Look, we're going to have Bob Baer in here. This is great stuff. Bob Baer is the guy that Syriana, the new film with George Clooney, is based on. It's sort of based on one of his books, but there's other questions I got to ask him. I'm about two pages away from finishing Sweeping with the Devil, How America Sold Its Soul for Saudi Crude. And I really want to talk to him about what is going on in Iraq and what the Saudi connection to it is, if any. This guy's a smart guy. Looking forward to having him. So stay with us. 44 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey,
it was a little abrupt, Bob. Sorry, we're just bringing you in while we started the show, but because I'm very excited that our next guest is back with us. He is the author of Sweeping with the Devil: How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's also the author of See No Evil: The True Story of a Ground Soldier in the CIA's War on Terrorism, on which the film Syriana, which opens this week in New York, is based. Bob Baer joins us in the studio this morning. Welcome back to the show, man.
Good morning.
Thanks a lot for being here.
It was weird because we were starting to, Yeah, we already started the segment. They're just walking Bob in. He's like, hey, what's happening? There you are. We're on the air.
Where's my coffee?
Hey, I'm sorry. Did you get it? You got it right there.
Got my coffee.
So you went to the premiere last night of Siriano?
Which is premiere.
How was it?
Surreal.
Hey, was it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're like, this must be a whole new world for you after being in the CIA and having to deal with Washington and having to deal with Hollywood. What is that to jump like?
How about spending 21 years keeping your picture from being taken? Ever.
Yeah, right.
When I published my book, they said, show us pictures. You got pictures. You got video.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and now you're in the movie, too. I was able to pick you out because I had seen you once before because you're on CNN and you were in here once before, but you have a little part in there where you're interrogating the guy who's playing you.
You know, I'll confess.
Yeah.
It was terrifying.
Really?
Playing against George Clooney.
They
gave me four lines.
Yeah.
And there probably were never three or four words in each line.
Yeah.
And I flubbed them over and over again. And you got 200 people listening to this. And not only that, you had the guy who financed the movie.
Right.
Showed up on set.
Uh-huh.
Jeff Skoll.
And you wanted to go undercover again, didn't you?
I wanted to run away.
But you did good. You were interrogating him. It felt very authentic and real. It sounded like something you might have done before.
Oh, I've been questioned like that.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely. By the FBI.
Well, let's talk about that in terms of how close this movie is to some of your real experiences and what was... Well, let's start with that. I mean, how much of this stuff is very close to the experience that you had?
Well, this is what the movie's about. It's mm-hmm. authentic.
Okay.
I mean, look, first of all, I can't watch spy movies.
Okay.
They're just so dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
And, well, you know, there's the funny ones I like because they're supposed to be comical.
Yeah.
Because they're so... There's no authenticity in these movies.
Right.
And it's dumb, and when it gets dumb, I lose interest, and this isn't the way politics work, and there's some evil guy, you know, twirling his mustache.
And then there's closure at the end.
And there's closure, yeah. And it's usually a happy ending, and the good guys win. This movie is authentic from A to Z.
It's chaotic, and I got to tell you something, Bob. I'm reading your book now. I'm reading Sweeping with the Devil, and I'm almost done with it. And even when I sit there and I can go over paragraphs again and again, just how convoluted the interaction between, you know, international, oil business, the government and the intelligence agencies, it becomes just brain swelling. It becomes very hard to follow. And I think the movie, because it was broken into four different narratives, it's a little more concise. But even the movie, on some level, it's like you got to pay attention.
You got to pay attention. First of all, this is a smart movie.
Yes, it is, definitely.
And if you're not ready to sit down and watch a smart movie and get worried and get upset, don't see it.
That's a lot of people go to the movies not to be entertained, but to get worried and upset. So
well, if you're going to see one serious movie this year, see Siriana.
But it is also very entertaining.
It's very entertaining. It's got a driving narrative, and people walk out of that exhausted from mm-hmm. the movie because of the emotional... impact of it.
Oh, yeah, because you're like, I can't believe this is really happening. I can't believe that this goes on. There's so much about what is going on in the world that we have no idea about, that politics doesn't cover, that the media doesn't cover.
And this is what the movies, it's all interconnected. And what's interesting is because you don't really get it until about a third of the way through the movie because all the characters don't know what the plot is because they only have a piece of it. And then it all starts to come together. So you just have to suspend... You know, your curiosity about everything ties together because it'll drive you crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get it at the end, of course.
Yeah, oh yeah. It all comes together, actually.
I'm not a consultant on the movie. I didn't write the script. I was worried about seeing it, you know, carrying something like this. But once I saw it, I said, I got to do publicity.
Yeah, okay.
So they called me up.
So he was happy with it.
Oh, I just brilliant. It was brilliant.
It was.
Otherwise, I was going to shut my mouth and disappear in Colorado. You'd never hear from me again.
Uh-oh.
No, it worked out.
Now, Bob Bear. When we look at the nexus of politics and intelligence, do people in the intelligence services understand the role that politics plays in their work from the very beginning, or is that something that's evolutionary?
They hate it.
They hate it.
Yeah. You know, today, these days, I'm being flooded by phone calls, not from the media, but from CIA people leaving.
Really?
They hate the torture. They don't want to be blamed for Iraq. The CIA knows it's getting nailed for WMD. It's mad at George Tenet for giving into the White House when Cheney went back and said, give me the intelligence I want. Everybody inside knows the stuff on WMD was bogus. And they're mad about it. And the place is further demoralized.
Well, let me ask you a question then. If we're going to get into the current events and move away from the movie for the time being, is that when you have it becomes very clear that the White House Iraq group and that the vice president's office was bullying the CIA perpetually to give them what they want. Is the CIA now what they're trying to do with it? just going to be this stooge operation?
The great irony is now that the CIA started saying in October in official assessments, we can't win the war in Iraq, and no one's listening.
Okay.
We'll never win it.
Right.
Of course, the White House is ignoring that. There's nothing we can do, no strategy, no change. It's going to make any difference.
So in the movie, because I want to keep you here for a little while, because I want to talk about Iraq, you know, in detail. I want to talk about what you're speculating in terms of what's really going on there. But in the movie, so people, I just realized that we have this conversation about a movie. No one even knows what it's about. So why don't you? It's a fictional country, really. It's a fictional Arab country that is in business with the United States. Based on what country?
It's based on a couple countries in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
Because the interesting thing in the film is they take real fields, real political situations, and they combine them together for this dramatic effect. Because in the late 90s, I was involved in, and the movie's about the U.S. government targeting a Gulf prince who's hostile to our energy policy.
Right.
And how George Clooney gets pulled in to this plot unknowingly to eliminate this prince. This is based on a true story.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved with this prince.
Mm-hmm.
It was decided that he was not going to help the oil companies, specific oil companies which are not named in the movie. And what happened in the course of the movie, and Clooney understands this, is they're skewing the intelligence. Mm-hmm. They're painting this guy as a terrorist, and he's brought in to get rid of this guy. And then he has this realization that he's been set up.
Believing the intelligence initially and then realizing
Just like in WMD. But this is not a war about Iraq. This is not a movie about Iraq. It's a movie of
this is about the oil
it's a parallel.
It's about the oil. Yeah, the U.S. government.
It's about an addiction.
Yeah,
come on,
let's
all
business. Yep.
Let's face it. It's an addiction.
Mm-hmm. And it's an addiction that I thought the way that he carried the narratives of you've got two guys who work in the oil fields, one who gets involved with extreme with jihadism, then you have the government story with Jeffrey Wright. Who is a lawyer working on behalf of the government. Then you have your story, which is the CIA guy on the ground in the country who's starting to realize that he's being used. It's pretty fascinating.
And you know what I like is that no one's going to be able to say, oh, it's the oil company's fault. We have suicide bombings. It's ultimately the Chinese.
Yeah, well, here we go.
It's a Chinese company.
We're talking to Bob Baer. The film is Syriana. It opens New York on Wednesday, November 23rd. It's scheduled for wide release on Friday, December 9th. It's rated R. We're going to keep him here because we're going to talk about reality now, because we have some questions about Iraq we need answered, and I think you're the only guy that can do it. You up for it?
I'm here.
You'll give it a try? All right. It's 57 past. We're talking to Bob Baer. We'll be back in a few minutes, so stay here. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's 6 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Our guest is Bob Baer, the author of Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's also the author of See No Evil, The True Story of a Ground Soldier in the CIA's War on Terrorism, on which the film Syriana, which opens this week in New York, is based. That film has George Clooney in it, William Hurt's in it, Matt Damon's in it. There's a ton of great performances in this film. Jeffrey Wright is in it, and it's really a movie about everything we don't understand about the CIA's place in the world, about the oil business, about the government's alliance with the oil business, about the corporate nature of how the world is run and the death that comes from that. And it's a very compelling film, and it's a very educational film. But I want to shift our sights now, Bob, to reality. I need to know some things about Iraq. I'm in the middle of, not in the middle, I'm almost done with Sleeping with the Devil. And one thing you never hear about in terms of speaking about Iraq, speaking about suicide bombers, speaking about the fact that it has now become a headquarters and training grounds and a place of dispatch for global terrorism, is that why, if I'm understanding your book correctly, did we go, in your eyes, was the agenda of the neocon death cult to go in there and take over Iraq primarily to detach itself from the Saudi oil paradigm?
I think absolutely. You know, you have a lot of people that are part of the architects of the war in Iraq. We're talking about boosting Iraqi oil to 6 million barrels. And their justification was that, Saudi Arabia is the evil kingdom. We can never trust it. It's unstable. And they're neo-fascists of sort, the Saudis. So if we went into Iraq, overthrew the government, took the oil contracts, we'd boost our oil production to 6 million barrels, which may only be half of Saudi's production, but we would still be ahead. And maybe the idea from there was to launch some sort of destabilizing operation in Saudi Arabia.
Now, do you think that any of the Wahhabists, any of the Muslim Brotherhood, any of the network of terrorists that brought us 9/11, and any of the ones being trained within Saudi, even in the school system, do you think they are behind any of the resistance that America is meeting in Iraq?
Most of the suicide bombers, I believe, in Iraq are Saudis, are coming out. They're coming across the border. They're coming directly from Saudi Arabia as well as Syria. We only blame Syria right now. It's an easy country. It's an easy target. We'd like to change the regime there. But it's the whole, it's all the Sunni Arabs in Iraq. It's, you know, the bombings in Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the names. They're all tribals. They're not what we would call Wahhabi Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
They're unlikely recruits. But the problem is we went into Fallujah. Marines had to kill a lot of people to take that city back. It was a dumb order. The Marines fought a great battle there. You know, it's a hard to fight a city like that against fundamentalists. But the point is they're coming back at us now, blowing themselves up in American hotels. So the more blood we shed, and the longer we're in Iraq, the more terrorism we're going to have, the more these people are going to flow over the borders into Saudi Arabia and Syria and Jordan.
Wow.
Bob Baer, is it too late now to change America's fundamental relationship with Saudi Arabia? Should it change? Could it make a difference if it was a little different?
The biggest irritant in our relations with Saudi Arabia today is Iraq. The longer we stay in Iraq, the more resistance there's going to be to us and the Saudi royal family. No question about it. You've got, these people are charged up. They believe that they're in an existential war against the West, against the United States. And again, the more blood we shed, the more problems we're going to have.
But what about when I read your book and I understand now that Saudi Arabia is armed to the teeth because that was part of their deal, is that, you know, we get their oil, they get our armaments, and everyone gets kickbacks from that sale and that exchange. Is there any chance in your eyes that they could be overrun by the Wahhabists? And that I know in your book you say that Wahhabists and jihadists are already infiltrating the Saudi military. What about that becoming a fighting force that's armed with whatever we gave the Saudis over the last 20 years?
How about nuclear weapons? That is the big question, is did they buy a system from Pakistan, from AQ Khan?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that, but there's that accusation out there. There's pieces of paper. And so what if there was a revolution in Saudi Arabia and some bin Laden figure got a hold of an atomic bomb? Conceivable. Mm-hmm. That's a worst-case scenario.
Scary case scenario. Bob Baer, since we have you here and since we don't often get CIA people, former CIA people here, I got to ask you, Bob Woodward and this whole CIA leak thing with Valerie Plame, Woodward is now saying that Valerie Plame's leak was no big deal. It was nothing more than gossip. As a former CIA operative, do you agree with what he's saying?
No, he's wrong. I mean, you know, the problem is, it's not whether we did any damage to national security by leaking her name. The problem is that once you start down that slippery slope of exposing intelligence agents for political means, you're kind of further eviscerating the CIA, any ability to tell the White House the truth. And the journalists play this game in Washington. They know the names, but the point is they didn't put them out. And somebody in the White House pushed the journalists to put them out. There's no question about it. There was an organized campaign. I mean, you know, today I can find out who's where in the CIA by asking journalists. But they have the sense not to publish the names.
Yeah.
Right. All right. So I'm curious in terms of what we're seeing now in Iraq. I'm gotten sort of obsessed with this because I've been wanting to talk to you about it. Is it seems that the American military is going to go into they're going to basically be overseeing a police force that has death squads within it that's going door to door.
What do you mean? They flayed people alive in this prison.
Yeah.
And this is a prison that's under our tutelage. I mean,
right.
We should have been looking into this. I mean, I know the guy, the Minister of Interior. He is a crazy fundamentalist and hates Sunni Arabs. So we're just inflaming the Civil War by having these prisons.
So the idea that that any democracy can be built with our help is bogus, and the idea that we're there to win some sort of military fight is bogus. We're there to guarantee that the people that take control are going to be able to take it into their own hands, which is not going to be militarily. It's going to be with death squads. It's going to be with devious means.
We are training the Shia and the Kurdish militia. We're arming them, which is only a recipe for civil war.
Okay.
But, you know, let's keep it. What are we doing to our military, putting them in this situation? I saw this in Vietnam. We systematically destroyed the military then. We had a perfectly capable military going into Vietnam. We had a perfectly capable military going into Iraq. And now we're destroying it. Why is anybody asking that question?
Well, but we just did. And what is the solution, Bob? I mean, it seems to me we've talked to some pretty smart guys here, and the ones that say we got to get out because it doesn't matter whether we stay there or not. What is going to unfold is going to unfold, and we're just an irritant. And what's at stake is the U.S. reputation, the military's reputation, the integrity of the military.
My position in 2003 was we better stay and do the job. Now it's we better get out because we're just inflaming the violence and losing American soldiers for no purpose at all.
But, Bob, we see Rumsfeld, Cheney, the people at the very top of the Bush administration, and the president himself, in fact, using the American military and their presence and their sacrifice as the rationale for staying. In other words, we can't cut and run now because that would be dishonoring the sacrifice that the soldiers who are already there have made.
The only thing the soldiers are doing is, in a way, covering up their mistake. They will not admit the mistake that we went in there, and I don't think they will until the administration has changed. They just can't. It was a huge error.
All right, so look, I want to tell people to go see Syriana. It's specifically for the education, it is a great movie. It's beautifully acted and it's beautifully shot. But there is stuff in there that now I got to go back and see it again. See, that's where I'm at. I saw it once, and after talking to you and reading your books, I learned some things. But now I got to get it into a more of a focus. And one of the issues that I had some confusion over is that, and I've asked you about this before, is that when the Americans come into a situation that, and you know the Middle East, and we're dealing with, I don't even know how many tribes. Different tribes of Arabs that have been conflicting for centuries, and that there are allegiances there and there are enemies there that go back hundreds and hundreds of years. I have to assume on some level that whatever's going to unfold in Iraq, Syria, Iran, Lebanon, all these different areas, whether the Americans are there or not is going to unfold anyways. And that the battles that are being fought are them.
They're going to unfold anyhow, but our presence, armed presence in the Middle East is going to only make things worse because it becomes an anti-colonial war.
So that could actually unify them.
Yeah, and one thing with lie we have to get rid of is those people don't hate us, our culture. They hate our politics.
Right.
I just spent a couple weeks in an Israeli prison talking to the Hamas and Islamic Jihad suicide bombing networks.
Mm-hmm.
Love American culture. They love Fox. They all watch Fox. Honestly, they knew who I was because I've been on Fox, and they're all watching it. So you're CIA, aren't you? They still did interviews. I went to a Hezbollah school. Were all the girls. I said, do you watch American TV? And they all raised their hand, all giggled. They were, this is a Hezbollah school, all in the Mahajaba and the rest of it. I said, who do you watch? And they were all yelling, Oprah, we love Oprah.
Interesting.
And then I said, well, what if you went back to war with Israel? Would you commit suicide in an operation? They said, absolutely, all these girls.
What were you doing there?
I was doing a documentary on suicide bombing for Channel 4 in Britain.
Wow, why don't we have that? Where's our documentary on that? Why the hell?
On Channel 4 in Britain.
I'll send you. Yeah, no, it's grim, the documentary.
Well, that's why it's not on American television. It should be on American television. That's unbelievable.
It's gruesome.
When's it coming out?
It's in Britain. Came out in August. It's in Australia right now.
It's actually in the theaters. It's not on the TV?
It's on TV.
We got to get a copy of that, can't we?
Let me get your copy.
All right, Bob Baer, thank you for joining us. You answered some questions I needed answered. Now I have to read the other book and I have to go see Syriana again. And that film opens in New York on Wednesday, November 23rd. It is scheduled for wide release on Friday, December 9th. It's rated R, but I would recommend, there's a little violence. Well, you can't bring two young kids because they're not going to understand. Listen to me. I'm like, everyone should know about this. Bring the children.
Yeah, bring the children.
Thanks, Bob. It was great seeing you again.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thanks a lot for having me.
You bet. 17 past, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
22 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Thanks for listening. Enjoy it. It's Monday. I hope you're pulling it together a little better than I am. Man, it took me like, what, 2 hours to even get my brain aligned? I'm glad it was aligned when Bob Baer was in here. Man, I love talking to that guy because, you know, you talk to guys like that, Riley, and you realize, yeah, we can be as obsessed as we want with domestic politics, with the president, with whatever it is that we're criticizing over, whatever it is we think are progressive values. What's really going on in this world is something that only a handful of people know. And you kind of get the feeling when you're talking to Bob that he's got a pretty good slice of it in his head.
Well, look, Bob Baer has seen the worst the United States government can do to people, to a nation, to its own people in some instances. And, you know, for a guy like that to be that straightforward with folks is what I find just absolutely significant.
Yeah, I always wonder about that. I wonder because in my worst suspicions, like when I first started hosting this show, I literally thought that we were doing something so revolutionary here that there was a chance I might be taken out. You know, and I believe that on some level. But then you start to realize, well, that's not really true. And it's not only because this is such a wonderful administration. I'm sure that they're not, it's not beyond them to facilitate something like that. Apparently, it's not beyond even a lobbyist to have someone taken out if you look at Jack Abramoff's story.
That's all an allegation.
Okay. But still, nonetheless, is that there has to be a free flow of information. Because one thing I'm learning about the neocon death cult is they thrive on confusion. They really do. If the culture is not already confused about what's really going on, they will throw several different points of view from their own camp out there to confuse people what's going on. The more information there is, it actually serves them. Because if there's some truth and some conflicting ideas that some people think are true, the more confusing it gets, the more outlets of crap there are, the more they can do whatever the hell they want.
Well, I'll tell you something, Mark. What's startling to me is to talk to people who really believe that the government should not share most information with the American people about how the government runs, about what the government is doing. They are perfectly happy to sit and listen to Donald Rumsfeld tell us how wonderful the war is going, to Condoleezza Rice telling us a variation on the same thing, George W. Bush telling us that if you oppose a continuation of the occupation, you're somehow unpatriotic. That's what they buy into, and they don't think other information should be shared with anybody, least of all them.
Blind faith.
Yeah, that's
that 35% approval rating. Those are those people. And those people are going to be hit the hardest when this stuff comes falling down, because it will come falling down and their hearts will be broken, but they'll rebuild themselves. They'll figure out how they were victimized, how the administration was victimized by crazy people that they disagree with, and they'll never see the truth. And obviously, when you talk to someone like Bob Baer, you see the movie Syriana, you realize that maybe even the truth that you think you know is not quite the truth. And business as usual is business as usual, and there's really no changing our course towards the end of things, that's for sure. We know things are tough in the job market as well right now, so we've decided to help out. We scanned through the Sunday Help Wanted listings and found this for our Morning Sedition Monday job listing. Maybe you've heard, folks, former Hollywood madam Heidi Fleiss is planning to open a brothel in Nevada that caters to women clients. I think this job listing is from her. Multiple positions available. New enterprise in Nevada seeks motivated self-starters with a can-do attitude. We need men to fill some openings. Actually, a lot of openings. In fact, many of the slots that are going to be available haven't been filled for some time. We need employees who are willing to bury themselves in their work. We're looking for someone who can rise to a challenge, work hard, and stay on top of things until the job is done. Our employees will be expected to put in some long, hard hours. Please note, this job entails constant drilling. In addition, strong oral skills are a definite plus. Of course, the job comes with benefits. We trust you will, too. If you would like to join a rapidly growing staff, or if you just have one, please apply. Oh, boy.
Who wrote that? Bruce Cherry.
It's got to be Bruce. He loves doing stuff like that. Here come the letters.
Yep.
And why doesn't someone put an end to that boys club that's going on over there in the morning? It's not progressive. I know sometimes. It's just fun. Hey, we got Howard Dean.
Yeah.
I'm glad we didn't do that right before Howard Dean. Some Vermonters. Is that what you call them? Vermonters?
Genius placement.
Yeah. Is that what you call people
Vermonters?
From Vermont?
I think so, yeah.
Well, they wanted me to wish Howard a happy birthday. Apparently, it was his birthday last Thursday. They're very excited to hear me talk to Howard Dean. And we got some serious questions to ask him about what the hell can we do to get this Democratic Party in order. And I hope he's got some answers. I mean, he's the guy that should have those answers, isn't he, Riley?
He is the guy with them. If he doesn't have them, nobody has them.
All right, so he's going to be up in a little while. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the war and about what's going on in this country. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning's Edition.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Monday morning. Make it stop. Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
Oh my God. I've eaten some Twizzlers. I've had a Fig Newton. I've had some coffee going here. I'm trying to get up.
Well, you know, you haven't gone to the corned beef or the brisket route like some people.
I'm on a slippery slope to Thanksgiving, Riley. I relapsed up in Vermont. The devils at the Libby's diner made me eat sausage gravy, man.
Well, you didn't eat the sausage.
But this was loaded with sausage. I feel ashamed of myself. I'm going to have to deal with this in the confessional tomorrow.
Uh-oh.
Look, it was very interesting talking to Bob Baer. I know a lot of you didn't realize we did because you're just tuning in. But his book, See No Evil, is the basis of the movie Suriana. And the other book that I'm reading, which is Sleeping with the Devil, is just blowing my mind. And let's talk about Iraq briefly because we're going to be talking to Howard Dean here in just a few minutes about the Democrats and where they stand on the war and why they don't stand strong or against it. I mean, look, you know, if you're looking at the war, the one thing that has become clear to any American who is keeping a pulse on any information coming out of Iraq is that, look, what is it making us look like over there? What are the Americans doing? I mean, look at Abu Ghraib. Okay, Abu Ghraib was a great example of how America should not be represented in the world, and that was instituted torture on behalf of the Pentagon. And then we have black sites, CIA torture prisons throughout Eastern Europe and throughout the world where people are renditioned, kidnapped, and tortured there, which is ineffective. We are now overseeing a failed military action in Iraq that has digressed into a guerrilla civil war that we help facilitate. If we stay there, it will only be to police a false democracy disguising tribal warfare in the form of death squads and militias that operate outside the law for the same goals as ours, whatever they might be at this point. We've not been publicly involved in a war like this in a long time. I mean, this is out in the public. Usually when you have a police action that this is going to turn into a vague attempt to stabilize something that is completely out of our control, a lot of these kind of things where we're just sitting there policing and enabling death squads was what happened in South America, happened under the radar of the public and didn't really come out till later and all the pieces fall in place. But right now, you can see it. And on top of everything else, we are making the world more dangerous by creating a headquarters for global terrorism. Now, this is far worse than Vietnam ever was in terms of the effect it could have on the rest of the world in terms of violence.
Well, in terms of the rest of the world, absolutely. But on the political side of this, you are now seeing this deep decline in the president's approval ratings overall, led by his large numbers of Americans' disapproval of his handling of Iraq. And there are people that are now saying, and I'm referring now to a column that was in yesterday's New York Times written by Frank Rich, that there's very little that the Bush administration can do to reverse the decline in support for the Iraq war, that it's not going to come back virtually no matter what else happens. And what is happening on the political side, and we're starting to see this with increased numbers of Republicans in Congress going against the president's wishes, what we're seeing is people looking out for their own behinds, peeling off from the president because they know that the president is a non-starter. In fact, and I didn't know this until I read this column, only one person out of the 13 Republican senators who are up for re-election next year, that person being John Kyle of Arizona, voted against that in that 79-19 resolution in the Senate asking for an Iraq exit strategy. So in other words, 13 out of the 14 that are up for re-election voted with the majority. They wanted an exit strategy. Most of these people have been dogged supporters of the war, including someone we mentioned earlier, Senator Rick Santorum, who couldn't even find his way to Bush's speech the other day in his home state.
Yeah, well, he's in trouble.
He's got a 16-point deficit to make
and
up.
And it's a beautiful thing. There's nothing more glorious than seeing a freak go down, and I hope he goes down. Even Rumsfeld obviously says that we are continuing to make progress training Iraqi security forces, which he says are at around 212,000. How the hell is that possible? I mean, he's disputing a report that came out in September, that said there are fewer than 1,000 troops that are capable of fighting without us. And that was a report put out there. That was a statement made by General George Casey. He said that there were only one battalion capable of doing it solo. Now all of a sudden there are, what, 200 battalions, Riley?
Well, look, Martha Raddatz of ABC News, the same day the Senate passed this resolution, said that there are 700 Iraqi troops who could operate independently of the U.S. military. 27,000 more could take a lead role in combat, quote, only with strong support from the U.S. military. And the rest of the 200,000-odd trainees that George W. Bush is talking about suffer from a variety of problems, like not following orders.
Well, here's what's happening. Despite whatever we can do by training troops or any of that, is that within the police system, in Iraq, they're operating on behest of the Minister of the Interior, is that there are active death squads that are purging neighborhoods and purging Iraq of Sunni Muslims, under the idea that they might be insurgents, but it doesn't matter. Now neighborhoods are starting to fraction. Shias are only allowed to be in Shia neighborhoods. Sunnis are leaving Shia neighborhoods. Shias are leaving Sunni neighborhoods. Shia and Sunnis that were once friends can no longer be friends. The civil war is well underway, and that's gonna happen with or without us. What I don't understand is why the Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate at this juncture in history cannot, you know, unanimously say we've got to get out of this. We've got to get out of it now. It's got to be organized. It doesn't have to be dramatic. But the bottom line is that anybody with any intelligence, and this is not going to be a defeat in the sense that we lose anything. You know, if the situation can be contained, it will be contained within the Iraq without us. And there might be a chance that we might not add a few extra 100 or 1,000 terrorists to the world.
Well, this is why Congressman John Murtha's decision to go public with a statement that the troops need to be withdrawn is so significant. Because before this, a lot of Democrats, I think, who should have known better were not prepared to take that leap. It was like they had an icy pool in front of them and they were scared to dip their feet. When a decorated Vietnam veteran dips his feet, actually when he jumps all the way in, then it makes it okay for others in Congress who are a little bit more timid, people who are more afraid for their jobs or whatever, to jump in behind John Murtha. And watch, over the next few days, you're going to see more and more of these folks doing that as we get closer to the Thanksgiving holiday. There's simply no way that these folks are going to sit on the fence for this, I hope, for much longer.
Well, you know, it's what frightens me is that they continue. There are certain factions within the Republican leadership that continues to try. If you try to discredit somebody like John Murtha with the public tone being what it is and with the realities that he understands, I like that email that we got that said, look, what is also at stake here is not just the war. It's just that if we get hit again by even a natural disaster in this country, we don't have the support. We don't have the troops. We don't have even the National Guard to make it okay here.
Yeah.
That the America is vulnerable, the troops are overextended, and recruitment is down below anything it's ever been before. It's almost non-existent.
Of course. And what's changed between now and 6 months ago is that fewer and fewer people among the American people and among America's elected officials are willing to stand with this administration while they continue to stonewall and lie to the American people. The very idea that the Bush administration is saying that there are more than 200,000 Iraqi troops that are ready to fight on their own is drop-dead absurd. Everybody who's looked at this and followed it for any length of time knows better than this.
Our next guest is the former governor of Vermont, a presidential candidate in last year's Democratic primary race, and the current chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Howard Dean joins us by phone this morning. Great to have you on the show again, Dr. Dean. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Good morning.
Well, look, Dr. Dean, I just got to ask you right out, is there any way that we can get all of the Democrats to agree that this war is the wrong thing right now and we've got to bring these troops home?
I think there is, and I think we're pretty close. I think Jack Murtha's leadership is just incredible. Oddly enough, the plan to get out, I think that I think we can get Democrats to coalesce around, is a plan written by a Republican, by Lawrence Korb, who's a former Undersecretary of Defense.
We know him.
Yes,
he's on
sure.
our show.
We've had him on.
He's a very bright guy, and he's written a very interesting piece, which I think is the key to how do you get out of Iraq without endangering our troops or maximizing Zarqawi's ability to cause mayhem, the terrorists over there. And the bottom line is, and I know Jack talked to him before he came out with his redeployment strategy. We need to redeploy our troops. The guardsmen need to come home. There needs to be a group sent to Kuwait to be on hand for the terrorist attacks. There needs to be a group sent to Afghanistan so we can do the job there where the government, which the government wants us to do. And I think that, and then we'll leave a few troops in Iraq over 2006, in order to help stabilize the situation there, which the president has made a huge mess of.
Yeah, well,
so,
that,
I think that's a reasonable plan. I think Democrats ought to coalesce around it. I think we can do that.
So you think that what happened last week with the Republicans hijacking John Murtha's proposal and making their own to sort of call them on what they're seeing as some sort of bluff was the right move?
Oh, I think that Democrats voting no on the Republican thing, that was just ridiculous.
Yeah.
What the Republicans did. They rewrote something, pretended it was honest. I mean, this is probably the most dishonest group of people we've had running America since Richard Nixon's administration. They actually remind me a lot of Nixon as well. You got Cheney in there talking about pusillanimous pussyfooters, and you got the president out there saying victory is at hand. It's just, these folks are, they just wouldn't know the truth if it hit them in the face.
Dr. Dean, can red state Democrats, who seem to be the ones that will at times peel away from the Democratic consensus on many of these issues, particularly those who are up for re-election next year, whether in Congress or in the Senate, can they be depended on to stay the course on this, to hold with the rest of the Democrats?
I think they can, but I think we've got to sit down and draw this consensus. And get people to sign on to this Lawrence Korb position. I think it makes sense. It's gradual. The Republicans practically have signed on to it in the Senate. They know their commander in chief has got us into a big problem here. And you start to see them start peeling away. You saw the Senate pass a resolution that 2006 should be the year of transition. Well, that was a step in the right direction for the Republicans to take, and I was just delighted.
In terms of the Democrats who are seeking re-election, in terms of the Democrats, coming together, as you're talking about, do you think it's right to do what former vice presidential candidate John Edwards did and admit that he was wrong in voting for the war in Iraq? Do you think that's...
I thought that was pretty courageous, and it
yes.
certainly got a lot of attention. And he didn't come out and dance around. He just said, look, I was wrong, period. That was the first sentence of his piece. I thought that was, I thought that was pretty courageous.
And what about some of the other part of the platforms that you're looking towards in terms of the Democratic momentum?
Our agenda is very clear.
Mm-hmm.
What we want is, one, honesty back in government, and I want to have tough legislation passed that both Democrats and Republicans will have to abide by. Two, I really do want health insurance for all Americans.
Yeah.
Six other countries have it. We should have it. Three, we want to balance budgets. Only Democrats balance the budget. You can't trust Republicans. They haven't done it in 40 years in America.
Yeah.
We want jobs in America that will stay in America, and renewable energy, I think, is the key to that. And I think that's a pretty succinct agenda for the American people.
Hey, it sounds good.
Now, you were talking earlier, Dr. Dean, about ethics, and we see that there's a lobbying mess involving Jack Abramoff that has touched a couple of Democrats. Is the party itself really ready to change the way Washington does business, even if it hurts the party in the short term?
They better be, because the country is more important than the party. I've had enough of ethics problems in the Congress, and we need really good legislation that'll stop this. And And, you know, I don't want to, you know, the Republicans came in 94 and suggested they were going to clean up Washington. And, of course, they've made it even more corrupt than it was before. I want to fix this problem. We need some honesty in politics. And I know some people don't think that can ever be achieved. And we'll never get to it 100%. But this is what's going on now. It's awful. We've never been at a time that I ever know of where the Republican leader in the Senate was under investigation. The Republican leader in the House was indicted. The Karl Rove has a security clearance, for God's sakes, after leaking wartime information. The president I don't even think he knows what the truth is anymore.
And the vice president's under suspicion.
Well, the vice president is you know, who the vice president is. Zero Agnew of 2005.
Oh. So how are you doing with money, Dr. Dean? You guys got enough to facilitate this thing?
I think so. We just broke the record in terms of off-year fundraising elections 4 years out. And that's without any soft money. So I think we're doing fine. You know, we've really, I think, done what we had to do. We've got people working right now in all 50 states. We've got, I think, a strong way of communicating with the American people that doesn't depend on mainstream media, and including thanks to you at Air America. I think we're in good shape. But we've got, you know, there's always more you can do. And the big thing we want to do is get people to, small donors, to give the Democrats money. We want everybody to go to Democrats.org and get a democracy bond. That's $10 or $20 a month off your credit card. We want to make the party dependent on Americans and not just big interests. And so we are trying to raise a lot of small dollars. And if they go to our website, Democrats.org, people can help.
Okay.
Okay. Doctor, there was a problem at one point with some congressional Democrats and your leadership. Has that beef been resolved?
I think it has. I mean, we now have the House, the Senate, the governors, and the mayors all working together on messaging and agenda. And okay. I think, you know, that stuff has been resolved. I'm always going to be an outsider, so, you know, there's going to be some discomfort, but I think Harry Reid has been an enormous ally. I mean, he really tells it like it is. And for him to have a lot of this sort of this real catalyst about whether the president's truthful or not started when Harry Reid decided to shut down the Senate over the fact that the Republicans had lied to him about whether they were going to conduct an investigation to find out what went on at the end of the Iraq War.
Right.
You know, he's a great partner. Nancy Pelosi has really brought the House Democrats together.
Good.
So I do think things are heading in the right direction, and I think things are going well that way.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dean. I was just in Vermont. They wanted to wish you a belated happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much, and happy Thanksgiving to you guys.
Okay, right, take care, Howard Dean. All right. Well, that was Howard Dean giving us a lowdown on what's going on in the DNC and what we have to look forward to. And I'll tell you, it's encouraging. I hope that what he is saying true. And it's certainly whether or not people send their own money to support this Democratic Party really depends on them getting that message out. And I hope Absolutely. What he is saying is true. It's 50 past. We'll come back. We'll do a little funny. We'll reflect. It's Monday. We got a short week this week. Thanksgiving's coming. And I do think there are plenty of things to be thankful for this Thanksgiving. Stay with us. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
It's 55 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
You.
Gonna have to put this thing down here. We just talked to Howard Dean, Dr. Howard Dean, the DNC chair, laying out some of the platform of the Democratic Party, saying that he is asking for private people, just us, regular Joes, like Joes and Marys, I guess, whatever, the men and women, to get involved and send some money. And I'll tell you, you know, that message has got to get out. We got to hear it out of the mouths of our representatives. He's talking about an alliance between mayors and governors, and I need to hear more of it from our senators, from Democratic senators, from Democratic congressmen, for everybody to get on the same page. There's a lot to look forward to if these people start talking the talk here. And I just don't think that people are going to get on board and start sending money unless they start hearing their representatives talk this talk, which is everyone gets health care. We're going to get out of Iraq. We're going to restructure that situation there so it takes care of our military. We need to get get on the ball with how we're going to keep jobs in this country.
And yeah.
He thinks it's through renewable energy resources. It's all good stuff, and I'm sure it's just the tip of the iceberg on it. I just need to hear it from all of them.
Don't forget ethics.
Now it's time for the liberal agenda. Here is your marching orders for today. One, in response to Bob Woodward's statement that the outing of Valerie Plame was just gossip and really didn't mean anything, have Oliver Stone make a sequel to All the President's Men called Is Bob Woodward One of the President's Men? Two, in honor of Bush's trip to China, add new menu item to Chinese restaurant menus. Lame pressed duck. Three, call Macy's for this year's Thanksgiving Day parade. Beg them to include a giant balloon of John Murtha. How about that? Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. So now Bush says there was nothing unpatriotic about opposing his strategy in Iraq. Wake up, sheeple. The salmon's in the net, and now he's trying to flip-flop his way out. You know what I'm saying? There you go, buddy.
It wasn't such a bad Monday, Marin.
No, it was good once I got up. David Poland, film critic, is going to be with us. We got Martin Smith, the frontline correspondent. He's going to be with us, and the Liberal Confessional.
We're going to have a lot of fun tomorrow. Good one, Marin.
You too.
Air America Radio. We'll be right back.